Call the Community Cares Listening Line at 877-719-1117. That's 877-719-1117.
And the previous program was the WBAI Evening News, heard daily at 6 p.m. Stay tuned for Extinction Rebellion Radio, and it's 6:30 p.m.
You're listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI.
Welcome to the Rebellion.
This is Extinction Rebellion Radio with Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney. Extinction Rebellion is an international movement that uses nonviolent direct action to press for action on the climate emergency.
This week, we have with us Alan McGonigal. He's a member of the Strategy Working Group for XR Boston. With that working group, developed a talk about XR's strategy, explaining why we use the strategy that we use. And he's adapting that talk to radio for us today.
This week's episode is Alan giving the talk pretty much without interruption. Next week's episode is discussion / question and answer between Elise, myself, and Alan, in response to what you're about to hear. So this week is the talk. Next week is the discussion about the talk. We did record this all in one session, but it broke down nicely since we have a half an hour time slot here to do the talk as one episode of the and discussion of the talk as the following episode. So expect that next week. Now, what follows is from a heavily involved member of Extinction Rebellion, and it makes sense of the decisions that Extinction Rebellion in the United States tends to make. But it's worth reiterating something that was a theme in episodes a while back. Extinction Rebellion is not an ideology. It doesn't have a set of binding commitments on its members apart from the four demands that guide what we're trying to achieve. It certainly doesn't have a set of binding commitments that aren't directly relevant to climate change. So this presentation today is explanatory, but not exclusive. In other words, we are definitely not saying that you have to agree with everything that follows to be active in XR, not even that everyone who is active in XR agrees with all of this. Those of us on this show don't believe we need dogma to organize. And that's not a wishy-washy position. It's the way the world is. You cannot, in 2022, mobilize any large number of people for a long period of time around a detailed and narrow set of ideological or strategic claims. The political cultural situation doesn't allow that. What you can do is say the type of thing you'd like to accomplish and why you're doing what you're doing, and invite people who can sign up to that broad goal to join you. And that's what XR is doing. So don't take this as the XR theory with a capital T or the XR worldview with a capital W. It's ideas about strategy growing out of the experience of doing activism in XR. It doesn't have to be anything more than that. So with all that preliminary, Alan, take it away.
Great. Well, thanks, Matt. And thanks, Elise. Really great to be here today. And I'm excited to be challenging the nebulous topic of strategy and what that means with you for XR in a climate ecosystem that's evolving and a political ecosystem that's evolving. I guess I'd like to start by kind of acknowledging that we exist within a movement. We're like one organization in a movement, and there's this ecosystem of climate organizations that we're operating in. And so no one of those groups has a single strategy that works and has solved the climate crisis. So no one has the answer. We need all groups to be working towards a solution. But I think that what is a valuable way of thinking about the movement ecosystem is, what is our place given what everyone else is doing? What strategy is incremental? What strategy is adding value given that other people already have their own strategies in motion? And for example, there are a lot of climate groups that do legislative work that are working on specific bills and lobbying at the state level or the federal level. And Extinction Rebellion doesn't do that. So we're doing something different. It doesn't mean that those groups are not important also. The second thing is kind of is how do we think about the word strategy? Because it gets used for a lot of things. And so I guess a framing I'd put out there is kind of what are the high level decisions that we can make as an organization, given some of the global context that we cannot change. Mm-hmm. So kind of taking for granted that there are things that we can't change, like, you know, the time frame that climate change has happened on so far, how the political system is structured. Like, we're probably not getting out of a two-party system in the United States, even though that may be ideal. And so taking some of those elements for granted and then planning our actions given that context. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Makes plenty of sense.
So going into XR's strategy, I feel like there's a couple elements that under a couple assumptions that kind of underpin the direction that we've taken, which is nonviolent civil disobedience and direct action to call attention to the climate emergency and put pressure on the political system. So just people already know that's our general strategy. Why is that? The first is that rapid action is needed, that it needs to happen now, today, and as fast of a time scale as necessary. We say, you know, 5 years to decarbonize or something in that time frame. Even if that's not likely, that is really the level of action that the science demands, and we should be advocating for that level and planning for that level of change. And I'm sure you've covered this already on many Extinction Rebellion radio talks, so I'm not going to really cover the science. But, you know, if we're already headed to, if we're already at 3 degrees Fahrenheit of warming and we're heading toward 8 degrees Fahrenheit of warming, mm-hmm. we're already well underway into this emergency. So I'm just going to take that for granted. Rapid action is really what's necessary. Slow action is not really what we should be planning our strategy around. The second point that kind of underpins our strategy is that action has to be government-led. And I'll say I'm personally a big believer in my life in taking both personal action of my own carbon footprint and political action through Extinction Rebellion. You know, I don't fly anymore. I eat vegan. I do as much as I can. Really, I do. But we have to acknowledge that personal change alone isn't going to transform society on the time frame that we're talking about, right? If we're talking about rapid changes necessary, personal action is already out of alignment with that first assumption. And if you want to look at examples of where personal change has been slow to take effect, look at, you know, for example, motor transit in the United States. My parents bought a hybrid car decades ago. The Prius was launched in 1997. So for the last 25 years, people have had a fairly widely available choice to adopt a hybrid vehicle or an electric vehicle. Increasingly. Right now, only 7% of vehicles on U.S. roadways are either a hybrid or an electric vehicle. So we talk about that solution a lot, right? And we've given people the personal choice to adopt those vehicle choices. And over 25 years, we've gotten to 7%. And I know there are a lot of intervening factors like the price of those vehicles, availability of charging stations for electric vehicles. And that is exactly why the government needs to intervene for many of these emission sources for carbon to make the change happen on a faster timescale. Because as we've seen already, we would look at many other examples, vegan food adoption or vegetarian food adoption. When people are left to their own devices, there is a percentage of the population that will take action, but will never exceed 10 to 25%. I mean, 25% would be a really phenomenal outcome for us to achieve on any one of those fronts. So the government needs to intervene, and that's the second underpinning of XR's strategy.
Or at least we won't achieve them on a rapid time scale.
Or at least it will happen over a much longer period of time over which climate change will, you know, stay on a relatively business as usual course.
Yeah.
So that's point two. We need the government to take action. Point three is kind of coming to acceptance, and this was hard for me. that the government isn't really talking about that right now, that it's not going to happen as a natural course of business, despite the science, that our political leaders are failing us in taking action on the climate crisis. Let's kind of talk about that through this framework called the Overton window. The Overton window describes a scale of the acceptable political platforms for politicians to hold. And you can apply this to any issue, but, you know, it goes from the most conservative, lowest action proposals to the most progressive, highest action proposals. And for climate change, the Overton window on the most conservative, low action side of things for the United States includes climate denial. That is still a viable political platform that many politicians hold in the United States. In the most recent Congress that's currently underway here in 2022 now, 25% of our federal Congress outright denies the existence of human-induced climate change. So that's just, I mean, that fact alone gives you a sense of where we're at. A quarter of people aren't going to even talk about it as an issue. Then on the other side of the spectrum, you have the most progressive proposals, the people who are pushing for action relative to the norm. And the most progressive proposals in the United States, even at a state level, are in the 2045 to 2050 net zero timeframe. So that those are the options available to us in the existing political system. Going back to our first point of emergency action is necessary, no one's talking about that. Not a single politician's political platform really talks about urgent today action, or at least not in any numbers that are meaningful on a political scale. Mm-hmm. So what that means is, if we think about our choices in this context, choice one, just think about let's engage on the political system to get the government to act. That's a failing point just to start. There's no politician who will actually support you in any meaningful numbers, in any meaningful coalition. You can't build a coalition when the most progressive starting point is 2050. Mm. So that is why Extinction Rebellion thinks it's a good thing for the movement to have a voice that's demanding something faster than what we could possibly pass in the current political system versus just negotiating through those channels. And so, you know, I kind of was hinting at this, but it's not just Republicans, it's both parties. Mm-hmm. Prior to Extinction Rebellion, I spent a few years working with a group under the National Resource Defense Council called Environmental Entrepreneurs, lobbying for faster climate action that was in alignment with good economic principles. And I talked to many, many representatives in the House, Senate. And I talked to them about ideas like, what if we required solar for new construction? You know, every new building that's installed, it should be net zero. It should have solar panels on it. I mean, obviously, we're at the point of that being a good policy now. What if we put a small tax of 10 cents or 20 cents per gallon on fuel, on gasoline, and use that money to fund low emissions transportation? Again, a very reasonable policy. Both of those were directly shut down by the people most in support, who would be most in support of them. And I've even seen politicians write a bill to try to acknowledge our conversation or many climate groups' conversations, and then actively work against it in back channels and shut it down in committee. So really, even in Massachusetts, which is a relatively progressive state, if you talk about any action that happens in the next 5 years or 10 years, you'll hit stone walls very quickly without even getting to the level of change that's really necessary.
You're saying they'll introduce a bill and then they'll work behind the scenes to prevent that bill from getting passed.
Yes, that absolutely happened. My House representative introduced a bill that would have set a faster net zero date, promoted that as part of her work with environmental groups, and then actively work with the House leadership, the moderate House leadership, to kill the bill because they were not supporters of it. She knew they would never let it pass. Mm. And so she wanted to look like she supported this bill, but wasn't actually going to put up a fight to try to pass it through the House. So that's some of my personal experience. But again, going back to the Overton window, when there aren't people who are accepting of the action that is necessary, you cannot really get far in a legislative process where you're introducing a bill, trying to get support for a bill, or modify a bill. Those options aren't really open to us. So that moves us to how do we, the fourth point, which is we need to shift the Overton window. We need to shift the range of options that are being discussed. We need to not engage on not just engage on the options being discussed and move them forward. We need to shift the total perspective that society has for what options should be on the table. And to shift the window, you don't take compromise positions. You have to actively change the narrative of what people are talking about as good solutions. And we need both the general public to understand this, that we are in an emergency, that new options that aren't on the table are needed, and they need to start demanding that from their politicians. That's what's going to get the politicians to start shifting their stances. If they're able to sit as the most progressive policyholder at 2050, they'll continue to do that and be better than all other options. So it has to come from the general public. So that is the core challenge of our that is the beginning point for our strategy. How do we reach the general public to get them to understand that we are in an active climate emergency and that they need to demand options that are not currently on the table from their politicians that include rapid change today? And that is what brings us to the next step, which is Extinction Rebellion focusing on street actions and disruption. So what does that mean, street action and disruption? These are tactics, part of, you know, nonviolent civil disobedience that have been historically proven to have a large impact given the percent of the population or the number of people engaging in the movement. People can have an outsized impact on political results by engaging in nonviolent civil disobedience. There's plenty of research out there on that. And again, I'm going to take that as a given that you've explored that to some extent in this radio program. So why is that effective? What is a framework for thinking about the effectiveness of that? In my experience planning actions with Extinction Rebellion Boston, there are three different ways to think about the audience that you're reaching. And really what you're trying to do is reach an audience. It's not enough to just disrupt a process in silence. It's about reaching people through the action. The first audience is through the participants in that action and their networks. So that's people coming to an action, having a role, telling their family and friends about it, posting it on their social media. And that may seem like the smallest scope. It is the smallest scope that we'll talk about. But I'll tell you that, you know, the first time I risked arrest with Extinction Rebellion, my parents' tone around the climate crisis changed. You know, they did start to immediately start taking it more seriously. You know, I got calls from my mom asking me about the climate action that I was doing. And, you know, she's partially doing that out of concern, but it is a signal to her that this is something that is very important. And that I think it's very important. It's not just a talking point. The second group of audience is onlookers. So this is people who are seeing the action unfold, pedestrians, cars, people who are engaging with the flyers at an action, having a conversation with them about what are you doing, why are you doing it, people pulling out their phones, posting on social media. XR is a very artistic, vibrant action community, and so often I'll see people pulling out phones to take video. And the last and largest reach is media. And having planned a lot of actions, I can tell you, you get a lot more press attention from a disobedient, civilly disobedient and disruptive action than you do a standard protest. You have to be careful not to create too negative of a narrative in the process because the media will cover that. But I've been to actions that have thousands and thousands of people as a standard protest that get literally no press coverage. You know, you can get fairly large turnout, no result. And I've planned actions with only 10 people participating in civil disobedience and gotten picked up by the Associated Press and heard stories about how people in Scotland or India heard about the story and then they'll tell me about it. So you can get literally 10 people can have an impact on countries outside of your own. So all three of those are the different audiences that we're reaching by being more disruptive. The last thing to think about, I think, when you're approaching action design and thinking about what actions are good for us in our current moment and what are which actions are strategic for us, are the kind of format of the action. And there's three categories of types of actions that we use in XR Boston in our planning. The first style of action is a general disruption. This is the type of action that maybe Extinction Rebellion is best known for. We're disrupting the public generally to call attention to the problem. You know, in the UK, the street blockages that they've done on a cycle for the last few years have gotten a lot of attention. They're disrupting anyone on their way to work, and they're sending a specific message. They want everyone to pay attention for a specific message. And that can be very effective because if you cause a big enough disruption, news channels have to cover the disruption happening. The second category, though, is a targeted disruption, which is similar in that you're trying to cause a disturbance to create attention, but you're picking a specific target that you would like to disrupt and trying to probably avoid disrupting other people. So that could be an Amazon distribution warehouse. That could be a government building or process. It could be a politician's home and going to their home. So in those cases, you're not trying to disrupt the general public. You're trying to disrupt a specific target and send them a message. Again, though, trying to engage the public through the media and other channels in that disruption. And then the third type of action that we use is creative visioning. And these don't necessarily disrupt any individual person, but the scale or the creativity is attention grabbing. It is not necessarily civil disobedience, but can involve it. And so an example of that is in XR Boston a couple of years ago, we climbed this 30-foot high sign called the Sitgo sign. It's a fossil fuel advertisement in downtown Boston that's a landmark. And we dropped a sign, our own sign that read Climate Justice Now over that sign. That's not disrupting anyone. Everyone is going about their own daily business, but it was a big enough feat that it got a lot of media attention for the action itself. So those are the three types of actions. And there's a lot more we could talk about around action planning and the strategy within action planning. But all that is to say that you have many modes, depending on what your current chapter or your current personal situation is, to use civil disobedience, nonviolent civil disobedience, to create an outsized attention grab on your message, on your topic, and get out there that we really are in the emergency. And so that is why Extinction Rebellion centers on that. So I'm gonna wrap up here, but the main question people ask is, can this be effective? Can this really work? You know, I'm an analyst for my job, and what are the numbers behind this? How do we measure that this is really successful? I guess I'll start with even having a sound strategy doesn't mean it's guaranteed to work. I think that a better question to ask is, could this theoretically work out? And we kind of talked through that. Could this theoretically work out on a time frame that makes sense for the climate crisis and actually shifts the Overton window to more dramatic action? If you want to see, can it work? Looking at the UK is a good case study in the effectiveness of the strategy, where they started their actions late in 2018. And over the first 2 years of actions, they received over 80% name recognition in the UK. And over that time, political issue polling show that people changed their ranking of climate from 9th to 3rd. So a huge change in how important people perceive the issue of climate change. And that was while Brexit was happening. So they started taking action. You can directly graph an increase in people's important perception of how important climate change is. And then within that same time frame, the UK became one of the largest countries to set a federal goal of 2050 net zero, which, again, not sufficient, but became one of the largest countries to set a target that early in binding legislation. So it can have a huge outsized impact for the number of people taking part in it. And again, even if it does not work on, you know, decarbonizing over 5 years, it may still be the most productive thing for us to do to reach the public, who are more open to listening than the politicians, and to get them to start to shift their perspective, to start to shift their Overton window and what they demand of politicians.
This has been Extinction Rebellion Radio.
You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI in New York, and this is This Day, February 22nd, in Racial Injustice. On February 22nd, back in 1898, Frazier Baker, a 40-year-old black man from Lake City, South Carolina, and his infant daughter, Julia, were murdered by a lynch mob. Mr. Baker was the first African-American in Lake City to be elected as U.S. postmaster. Despite strong opposition to his appointment from the white community, Mr. Baker held the position for 6 months. During this time, he was shot at twice and received many death threats. The Bakers lived in a small building just outside Lake City. Their home was formerly a schoolhouse that had recently been converted into a residential dwelling and post office. Witnesses reported that a number of white men circled the Baker house at night, set the building on fire, and fired up to 100 bullets at the house while Mr. and Mrs. Baker and their 6 children were inside. Mr. Baker was shot to death while trying to escape the burning house. As Mrs. Baker fled the house, carrying Julia, the baby was shot dead in her mother's arms. Mrs. Baker and her other children managed to escape with their lives, but 3 of the children were wounded by gunshots and permanently maimed. Mr. Frazier and Julia's remains were burned beyond recognition. The local white newspaper insensitively reported that they had been, quote, cremated in the flames, unquote. The Federal Post Office building and all of its equipment were consumed by the fire, and the citizens of Lake City, South Carolina, were left without a postmaster and without a post office. Members of the black community held a mass meeting at Pilgrim Baptist Church and drafted a public statement expressing outrage about the lynching. The murder prompted a national campaign of letter-writing activism and advocacy spearheaded by Ida B. Wells and others, which ultimately persuaded President McKinley to order a federal investigation that resulted in the prosecution of 11 white men implicated in the Baker lynching. But despite ample evidence, an all-white jury refused to convict any of the defendants. This has been This Day, February 22nd, in Racial Injustice, and this is listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI.
When trumpets were mellow and every gal only had one fellow, no need to remember.
Hi, I'm David Kenny of Everything Old Is New Again. Every Sunday night at 10, please join me then, and please support WBAI at our brand new old number, which is 212-209-2950. Again, that's 212-209-2950. Hey, it's our old number, but it's new again, because everything old is new again. I like it.
The previous program was Extinction Rebellion Radio, heard Tuesdays at 6:30 p.m. right after the WBAI Evening News. Stay tuned for more programming coming up in the next hour. We Only Want the World with Sansara Teller will return at its regular time next Tuesday at 7 p.m. This is